Twilight by Tuesday, Love Sang Rampa. Read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 3. It was cold in Calgary. Snow lay all about, obscuring the railway tracks, covering the frozen river. The cold was terrible, a cold that seemed to penetrate everywhere, a cold which seemed to magnify sound from the frozen streets. Drivers still whirled along, seemingly without a care in the world. Calgary, we are told, has two claims to fame. It has more cars per capita, why not say per person, than any other place on the North American continent. And the second claim to fame, if fame it can be called, is that the drivers of Calgary are more dangerous than any other drivers on the North American continent. People run around as if they haven't a care in the world. Then, presumably, they wake up in heaven or the other place and find that they have. They've got a load of karma from the people they killed in the accident. But the cold this day was just fantastic. And then across the sky there came a peculiar band of cloud, or should I say cloud and light intermixed, and the air immediately grew warmer, as if someone up there had taken pity on the poor mortals of Calgary and switched on a very efficient electric heater. The air suddenly grew warm. The crisp snow became soggy and water poured from rooftops. The Chinook winds had come. The greatest blessing of Calgary, a special meteorological formation which suddenly brings a whole lot of hot air. Well, look at their government. From Vancouver, hot air which turns a frigid day into a mellow day. The snow soon melted. The Chinook winds persisted during the afternoon and evening, and on the following day there was no trace of snow at all in Calgary. But letters do not bother to wait for warm weather. They come all the time, like bills and income tax demands. They wait for no man. They wait for nothing. Here's a letter shrieking in bright fluorescent red ink. Some cantankerous lady wrote, "You tell us about mantras, but the thing you tell us are no good. Your mantras don't work. I wanted to win the sweepstake, and I said my mantra 3 times, and I didn't win it. What have you got to say about that?" Well now, why do some of these old biddies get in such a state? It's shockingly bad for their blood pressure. It's far worse for their spiritual development. In any case, she wasn't saying my mantra. She was apparently doing a thing against which I specifically warn one. It is not right to try to win a gamble by the use of mantras. A gamble is a gamble, just that, nothing more. And if you try to use mantras for gambling wins, then you do a lot of harm to yourself. There have been a lot of people, though, who seem to have had bad luck in not getting their mantras in good working order. Probably it is because they don't set about it in the right way. Undoubtedly, it is because they cannot visualize what it is they want to get over to the subconscious. You see, you've got to know what you are saying. You've got to convince yourself what you are saying. And having convinced yourself, you've got to convince your subconscious. Look at it like a business proposition. You want something specific. It must be something which your subconscious wants as well. Let's say, for example, and this is just an idle example, remember? So don't write me a load of letters saying I have contradicted myself or something like that, as so many of you absolutely delight in doing, and most times you're wrong anyway. Let us say that Mr. Smith wants a job and he's going to do an interview tomorrow, or the day after that, with Mr. Brown. So, Mr. Smith churns out a mantra. He mumbles while he is thinking about getting this nonsense over with so he can go to the pictures or go and get a drink or go and find a girlfriend or something like that. He tries to get it over and done with, and having said it 3 times, he's convinced he's done everything necessary, and the powers that be are responsible for everything else after. Then Mr. Smith rushes out, goes to the pictures, perhaps goes to a bar, gets a swig or two of beer, picks up a girl, and when he goes for his interview with Mr. Brown, well, he doesn't make a hit. Of course he doesn't. He hasn't prepared for it. He hasn't done his homework. What he should do is this. Mr. Smith wants a job, so he's applied for a job having assured himself that he has the necessary qualifications and abilities with which to carry out the tasks imposed by that job if he gets it. He's heard from a Mr. Brown saying that Mr. Brown will grant him an interview at such and such a time on such and such a day. A sensible Mr. Smith tries to find out something about Mr. Brown if he can. What's the man like? What does he look like? What's his position in the firm? Is he a friendly type? Well, you can usually find out those things by phoning the telephone girl of the firm concerned and asking her. A lot of these girls are very flattered indeed. So, if Mr. Smith says he's trying to get a job with the firm and he's going to be given an interview on such a date, the girl will tell him something about Mr. Brown, the interviewer, after all. He can say, I shall soon be working with you, so let's make a friendship now. Tell me what you can. The girl invariably responds favorably if she is approached in the right way. She's flattered that someone has appealed to her for help. She's flattered that someone thinks she's such a good judge of character. She's flattered to think that a possibly new member to the firm had sense enough to get in touch with her, so she gives the information. Perhaps she can tell Mr. Smith that a picture of Mr. Brown appeared in the Dog Washer Monthly magazine or something when he took up his new appointment with the firm, etc. So Mr. Smith goes along to the local library and takes a good, hard look at a picture of Mr. Brown. He looks at the picture, and he looks at it and fixes it in his mind. Then off he goes home, keeping Mr. Brown's face in his mind. There he sits down and imagines that Mr. Brown's in front of him, unable to talk. The poor fellow just has to sit and listen. So Mr. Smith unloads a talk about himself, about his own abilities. He says what he has to say convincingly, and if he's alone, he can say it in a low voice. If he's not alone, he'd better just think it to himself. Otherwise, some other person in the house might take Mr. Smith off to the place where people like that are taken. because not everyone understands visualization, mantras, etc. If this is done right, then when Mr. Smith goes to see Mr. Brown, Mr. Brown has a distinct impression that he's seen Mr. Smith before under very favorable terms. And do you know why? Well, I'll tell you. If it is done properly, Mr. Smith will have made his mark in the ether, and his subconscious will, during the time of astral travel, meet and discuss things with Mr. Brown's subconscious. Oh, good gracious me, it really does work. I've tried it time after time. I know hundreds, thousands of people who have tried it too, and it does work if you do your job properly. But if a lazy Mr. Smith just thinks of girl chasing, film watching, and beer drinking, then his mind is on those things. Girl chasing, film watching, and beer drinking. And he doesn't get any response from Mr. Brown's subconscious. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll make a worthwhile suggestion to you, to those of you who find it hard to concentrate in the right way. Now, there are such things as rosaries. Catholics have them, Buddhists have them, a lot of others have them. Not everyone has them like hippies, just for little things to hang on to make them look different. So, let's think of a string of beads. All right, what are we going to do about the beads? First of all, we have to make the type of string of beads we want. How many beads are we going to have? And does it matter how many beads there are? It most certainly does. Psychiatrists are a pretty dumb lot, really. And I think most of them are crazier than the people they treat. It's like setting a thief to catch a thief. You have to get a lunatic to treat a lunatic. So to my way of thinking, most psychiatrists are as crazy as can be. But sometimes, by accident, they come up with a piece of information which can be of use to someone. So a gang of these hedge shrinkers have come up with the idea that it takes 45 repetitions to get a thing safely locked into one's subconscious. So, for those of you who can't concentrate on a thing properly, let's have a string of beads. Let's make it 50 beads for good measure. So you start off by going along to the best hobby or handicraft store you can find and pawing through a load of loose beads until you find the type, style, pattern, and size which most appeals to you. I find that the best ones for me are of an average pea size, and the ones I have are of polished woods. Then you get a length of nylon cord on which the beads will very easily slide. Then you buy your 50 beads, and they must be identical in size. And then if you want to, you can get about 3 larger ones to act as a marker. When you get home, you thread 50 of your beads on this nylon thread. Make sure they slide easily. Then tie a knot, and on the 2 pieces of thread hanging down from the knot, thread perhaps 3 larger beads and knot the end again. The idea of this is merely to tell you when you have completed 1 complete circuit of your beads. So then, you sit down as comfortably as you can in a chair, or lie down if that's more comfortable. Stand on your head. Doesn't matter how you sit or lie, so long as you are comfortable and you don't have muscles under tension. Then You decide what you want to say to your subconscious. Now, it's important what you say and how you say it. It just definitely, definitely must be positive. You cannot have a negative thing or you'll get the wrong result. It should be, I will something or other. It should be short and sharp and definitely something which can be repeated without too much strain on the intellect. You'd be surprised how strained some intellects become. Mr. Smith wants to impress Mr. Brown, so he could say, and this is just an example, mind you, don't quote me, I will favorably impress Mr. Brown. I will favorably impress Mr. Brown. I will favorably impress Mr. Brown. Well, poor old Mr. Smith has to repeat that 50 times. Each time as he gets to Mr. Brown in his word, he flips one bead back, and so on, until he's repeated 50 times. The idea is to use the beads as a form of computer, because you cannot say, I will favorably impress Mr. Brown. That's it, I've said it once. I will favorably impress Mr. Brown. That's said twice. I will favorably impress Mr. Brown. That's three times. Because you will get all mucked up with your words and with your instructions to your over-self. Having decided 50 times that you're going to favorably impress Mr. Brown, then you get down to it and talk to him as if he were actually in front of you, as I've said several paragraphs ago. So that is really all there is to it. You should handle your beads very frequently to imbue them with your personality, to make them part of you, to make sure each one slides properly, to make sure that you can flap the wretched things around without having to definitely think about moving them. It has to become second nature to you. And if you have other people in the same house with you, then the best thing you can do is have small beads which you can keep in your pocket. Then you can put one hand in your pocket and move around, and nobody will know what you're doing, except being so slovenly they think that you keep your hand in your pocket all the time. Now, once again, I'm going to tell you that, yes, quite definitely you can win a sweepstake by using mantras, but only if you know exactly who is going to make the sweepstake draw. If you're going to get a positive reaction, you have to know who you're going to act upon. It's too utterly foolish for anything to say that you are going to do a mantra for the person in charge of such and such a thing. That's no good. You must actually know the person who is organizing a draw, or who's going to draw the ticket from the box or whatever it is. If you cannot do that, you cannot place any faith at all in the mantra. It means that you must address your remarks to some subconsciousness and not just fritter your energies into idle space. Is that clear? If you know, then, that Mrs. Knickerbaum is running the race for the Slithering Snake Society, and that the take is going to be worthwhile, then you can address your remarks to the subconscious entity of Mrs. Knickerbaum. And if you do it on the lines suggested in this chapter, you have a good chance of success, unless someone else is doing it, and they've got a bit more think power than you have, in which case you lose out. But a warning, and there is a warning to everything. You've got to stop and give way to approaching traffic. You've got to yield here. You've got to halt there, etc., etc. Everything is a warning, so here's another one for good measure. Money, which has been acquired by means of a mantra like this, doesn't necessarily bring happiness. Most often it brings misery. And if you want it entirely for selfish reasons, then you can be quite sure you're going to get misery. So don't do it. I have had letters from people saying, "Oh, Dr. Rampa, I do want to win the such and such sweepstake, and I know you can help me. You can let me win $100,000, and I'll give you 20%. That'll make it worthwhile for you, won't it? I'll give you the number of the ticket," etc., etc. And the answer is, "No, madam, it is not worth my while. I do not believe in gambling. And if I go into this with you for 20%, then I should be as culpable as you. And anyway, madam, if I wanted to do this, why should I do it for just 20% from you? Why shouldn't I do it for myself and get the whole lot of money?" So many people see advertisements for infallible schemes for winning at the horses, and they don't seem to realize that if the propounder of the infallible scheme had indeed something which was successful, he wouldn't be selling the idea to someone else for a dollar or two. He would be making millions using his own infallible system. That's right, isn't it? It might be a good idea here to say a bit more about these people who are so anxious to pray for one. I get a lot of letters from people who say that their group will be praying hard for me, etc., etc. Now, I don't want anyone to pray for me. They don't know what I'm suffering from, and it is definitely, definitely harmful for all these praying people to mumble off their prayers without having the slightest idea of what they are doing. Let's mention something which is capable of concrete expression, something which can be used as an example. Prayer is most often useless except in the negative sense, and so cannot be demonstrated. Hypnotism can. Let's say that we have a girl suffering from some complaint. Well-meaning friends insist that she go to a hypnotist. Now, being a bit weak, she goes to this hypnotist. The man may be very well-meaning indeed. He may be carved of solid gold with jeweled insets, but no matter how well-meaning he is, unless he's a qualified medical man, he doesn't know about the girl's illness, and so, although without any doubt whatever, he can disguise the symptoms from which the girl is suffering, he cannot cure her. And if he disguises the symptoms or conceals them so that a qualified doctor cannot find the symptoms, then the girl might become worse and die, adding a load to the hypnotist's karma. and to the stupid friends who sent the girl to the hypnotist. As I know only too well, if one goes to a hospital in acute agony, the medical staff there will not give one drug to relieve one of the pain until they have studied all the symptoms. Only when they have become acquainted with all the symptoms will they do anything about relieving the pain. Obviously, the symptoms are the things which tell the doctors what the patient suffers from. So, when we get people praying their heads off, they might, by some accident of telepathy, cause a sort of hypnotic effect and induce a suppression of some of the symptoms, or even the vital symptom. I always look at these people who want to pray for me as my greatest enemies. I always say, God protect me from my friends. My enemies I can deal with. So, no more prayers. No more prayers unless you are definitely and positively asked by the sufferer to pray. If the victim asks for the prayers, then that lets you off the hook. But until then, pray for yourself. You probably need it as much as anyone. Someone wrote to me and took me to task, saying that I couldn't have any friends at all, saying that no one could possibly like me because I only mention people who write rudely. As a matter of fact, she was a woman's liber, the lowest form of existence, so far as I'm concerned. Yeesh. So perhaps it might be a good thing to tell you now about some of my friends. Some wrote to me, others, such as Hi Mendelssohn, who I'll tell you about a little later. In that case, I wrote to him. It has its problems, I suppose, writing about my friends, because if I mention them just as they come into my mind, that stupid women's lib person who writes so often and always full of hate will say that I am mentioning men before women or something. So I think I'll mention just a few of my friends alphabetically. In that way, surely no one could be offended. For the benefit of some people, I will say now that I will not give the address of any of these people that I mention. Now, just a week or so ago, I received an unstamped letter from a man who said, "State names and addresses of people who can do astral travel so that I can check up on you." The poor fellow was so much of a bum that not only did he omit putting a stamp on the letter, he didn't sign it, and he didn't put an address on either. So I hope he reads this, and he can appreciate my explanation that I never, never give the names and addresses of other people without first receiving their written permission. I have had a lot of trouble with people getting in touch with me, asking about others, and I am always irate on such occasions and give the rudest rejoinder that I can think of. So, I give certain names of certain friends, not all my friends, because I'm not compiling a telephone directory, but just certain people who spring quickly to mind, but under no circumstances will I give their addresses. Yesterday we had a visitor, one whom we were expecting. "We" is Mrs. Rampa, Mrs. Rouse, Miss Cleopatra Rampa, and Miss Tadilinka Rampa, as well as myself. Soon, a great big station wagon rolled up, and out came John Biggrass. We have known him quite a time. We knew him first when we were at Habitat in the city of Montreal. Biggs, as we call him, encountered me there. Or would it be more correct to say that I encountered him? Anyway, we liked each other and we've kept a very close association ever since. Biggs used to be a top-flight salesman for medical products. He got some sort of award on two or three occasions for selling so many goods. But then, when we left Montreal, he came to the conclusion that there wasn't much future for him in Montreal. So he followed us all the way across Canada, driving a mobile home thing with himself and his two cats. Wayfarer, the gentleman cat, is a most immense creature and extremely kind-hearted. His wife cat is a gentle creature who is about half the size of Wayfarer. They all settled very comfortably in Vancouver, where Biggs has a job that he likes, a job that affords him plenty of movement, plenty of travel, and a chance to meet people. And his cats keep house. Yesterday, then, Biggs and his two cats came here to Calgary, and they're staying near us for about a week while they have a vacation. Biggs thinks Calgary is a nice place, but, of course, it's very small compared to Vancouver. Never mind, though, diamonds are small things, aren't they? And lumps of coal are not. Biggs, then, could be classed as one of our closest friends, because we see most of him, and we are in contact two or three times a week by phone. There are two ladies who were among the very first to write me when The Third Eye came out. One of them is Mrs. Cuthbert, so I can say, good gracious me, I must have known Mrs. Cuthbert about 17 years. We correspond quite frequently, but I've never met her. So another of my friends, then, is Mrs. Cuthbert, and I will mention the other lady later alphabetically. I have to remember that woman's liver who's my bête noire. Now, we come to a real rough diamond, a man we all like very much, Frogs Freneau. The Frogs bit is because he's an Englishman, descended, or ascended would sound better, from an old French origin family. He's always addressed here as Frogs. Anyway, now he lives in New Brunswick. We met him when we lived there also. He's a fine engineer, and although he sometimes speaks quite roughly, growling like a bulldog or worse, he still has a heart of gold. Mind you, now that I've written down heart of gold, I wonder how a heart of such a metal could work in a human body. Never mind. Metaphorically speaking, heart of gold stands for Frogs Freneau. I remember when I was staying at a hotel in St. John, New Brunswick. Frogs drove me there, and he heaved and he hoved and he puffed and he roared, and he pulled my wheelchair backwards up a flight of stairs. It nearly killed him, mind, and it even more nearly killed me, but we got up that flight of stairs with poor old Frogs looking like a frog should look when he is all puffed up. So let me say hi to you, Frogs. Hey, I'm still on the Canadian continent, so let me mention another one. My good friend Bernard Gobaye Oh, yes, we know Bernard very well. He's a very nice man indeed. He used to be, in a manner of speaking, my landlord, because when I was living at Habitat, he was the man in charge. He looked after things, and he looked after things very well indeed. In fact, he looked after things too well, because he was so efficient as an administrator that he got moved from Habitat and sent as a sort of troubleshooter to another big apartment complex where they were having troubles. Habitat wasn't the same with Bernard Gobaye missing, and so, as I was having trouble with the press as usual, that proved to be the last straw, and off my family and I went, far from those haunts of Habitat. But Bernard Gobaye and I keep in touch, and in fact I had a letter from him this morning. I wish he was here. I wish he was my landlord now. But Calgary's a long way from Montreal. But why don't we take a trip? Let's go further than Canada. Let's go to Brazil for a change. In Brazil, there's a most eminent gentleman, Mr. Adonai Grassi, a very good friend indeed. He's learning English, especially so that we can correspond without the intervention of a third person. Adonai Grassi is a man with unusual talents, a man with drive and compassion. He's not one of those ruthless dictator-type people. He's a man well worth knowing, one of the best type of men, and I predict that he will make his name known thoroughly in Brazil and elsewhere. So, how can I send my saludos in Portuguese? But he knows what I think of him, and I do think a lot of him. Shall we go a bit further to greet a gentleman from Mexico, Mr. Rosendo Garcia? Agreed, he's now living in Detroit, USA, but he's still a Mexican, definitely one of the best types of Mexicans, a gentle, educated man who wouldn't hurt a fly, a gentleman of the world who has had many, many hardships, definitely not of his making, one whom we could say with absolute truth is on his last life. Next time he will indeed go to a much, much better round of existence. Back again we go to greet my friend, Mr. Frederick Cosin, in Brazil. He's a friend of Adonai Grassi. Unfortunately, I wrote quite a lot about Mr. Cosin, but he sent me letters and a cable protesting at what I said about him. He's too modest or something like that. Frankly, I don't know what it's all about, but I will just say that he is a man closely associated with Mr. Grassi. And now, back to a real old stager, my dear old friend, Pat Loftus, who I met, so many years ago. Mr. Loftus is a gentleman of nature, one of the finest men one could meet. He's retired now, but he used to be an Irish policeman, one of the guardias. And as a policeman, he had a most enviable reputation as a kind man, but a stern one, too. I admire Mr. Loftus very much indeed. We have kept closely in touch, and if I could have a wish granted, that wish would be that I could see him again before either of us leaves this world. We're not so young now, either of us, and there's not much time left, so I fear that this will be a wish unfulfilled. Mr. Loftus was one of that gallant band of men who founded the Republic of Ire. He was one of the heroes of those early days, but he was not favored by chance or by fortune, as so many of the others were. If fortune had smiled a little on Pat Loftus, he would have been at the head of state in Ireland instead of a retired policeman. Yes, Mr. Loftus is one of my oldest friends, one of my most esteemed friends, and I'm sure that living beside the Irish Sea, he often looks out, as he tells me, and thinks of me 3,000 miles away. Well, Pat Loftus, I think of you, my friend. I think of you. But we've got to come back to Canada, thinking of Mr. Loftus and the way he sits beside the sea looking out towards Canada. And that reminds me of Sheila McMoran. She is one of the people who wrote to me and whom I've met, and yes, she is a friend. She is a woman of many abilities, many talents, a most capable woman, and one whom anyone could like. A bit further on your journey again. My friends do seem diversified, don't they? Let's get back to Montreal again and discuss a very particular friend, Hi Mendelssohn, whom I have referred to as being the most honest man in Montreal. Yes, and I certainly believe it. Some time ago, when I was in New Brunswick, I wanted a used camera. My wife was idly flicking over the pages of the evening newspaper, and she said, "Well, why not write here, Simon's Camera, Craig Street West, Montreal?" So, I was a bit slow on the uptake, but eventually I did write to Simon's Camera, and I received a very satisfactory reply from Hi Mendelssohn. He treated me as an honest man, no cash in advance business with him, no waiting until the check was cleared or anything like that. He treated me as I like to be treated, and not only have I dealt with him since, but we've built up quite a warm friendship, and I hope he likes me as much as I like him. He's had quite a difficult life, taking over the business from his father and building it up until now. I'm absolutely positive that he has a bigger stock, a more diversified stock than any other photographic store in Canada. Sometimes, just for amusement, I've asked him if he has such and such a thing in stock, and always the answer has been yes. So, Mr. Hi Mendelssohn, it's a pleasure knowing you, my friend, and you have a distinction in that I wrote to you. You did not write to me. Shall we have another M? Okay, let's move across the border to the USA and say hello to Mr. Carl Moffat. Because of his interests, I've christened him Paddle Boat Moffat. He makes models, superbly accurate models, ship models, of course. But as I told him, there's no point in making silly old galleons and ancient ships that go along by the wind. He ought to make paddle boats, and so he's doing just that. Some months ago, he made a beautiful model paddle boat and sent me some photographs of it. But then he sent the paddle boat as a gift, and do you know, our customs people here in Calgary wanted to charge such a fantastic price on it that I couldn't afford, and nor could Paddle Boat Moffat. And so I was deprived of one of the few pleasures left to me. I was deprived of having this model, which had been so lovingly made for me by a very good friend, Paddle Boat Moffat, in the USA. The model had to go back because the customs people wanted hundreds of dollars in customs duty on a handmade thing, and they were most unreasonable about it. Still, it's only what one can expect from customs people. I've never got on with them at all. This time, we're going to do some ocean hopping. We're not going to stay on the North American continent, although, of course, we've got to come back. We're going, instead, to Japan, Tokyo. Here lives a very good friend of mine, one who first wrote to me and then who came to see me all the way from Japan, Kathleen Murata. She is small, highly talented, but doesn't appreciate her own abilities. If she could only realize those abilities, she could succeed at book illustrating, etc. Because, as I say, she is enormously talented. Kathleen Murata is an American woman married to a gentleman of Japan. I think she suffers greatly from homesickness. I think she wants to get back to the USA, even though that country is just about flooded as an aftermath of Watergate. But she wrote to me, I suppose, in the hope of getting someone to correspond with her as a link within the North American continent. And we have established a very firm friendship. She came to see us when we were at Habitat Montreal, and she stayed with us for a time in our apartment. We like her a lot. But back again to Canada, and this time to one of Canada's islands, where live Mr. and Mrs. Orlowski, Ed and Pat Orlowski, and they're talented too. Ed is a most skillful craftsman. He can do modeling. He can do all manner of artistic things, but he's never had a chance in life. He came from old Europe and, I suppose, settled in Canada, and he brought many of the old European skills with him. But I suppose he's on his last life on this earth and, as such, is getting more than his share of hardships. He has a very poor job, very, very poorly paid. And yet, I tell you, truly, the man is a genius. All he needs is an opportunity. All he needs is a bit of financing so he can make his statuettes and his figurines. At present, I have given him some designs so he can make pendulums, touchstones, and Eastern-type pendants, things at which he excels. Yes, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you his address. I'll break my rule, so that if you want to order some wonderful articles, you can write to Ed Orlowski and find out what he's got available. All right, then. Here's his address. Mr. Ed Orlowski, Caves Head, York Post Office, Prince Edward Island, Canada. Not too far away from that place is a very good American, Captain George Bud Phillips, a most admired friend of mine, a man who goes racing around the continent in a Learjet. He's a senior pilot for a very big firm, and he certainly sees life, usually from about 30,000 feet. I know Captain Phillips quite well, and the more I get to know him, the more I get to admire his sterling qualities. Let's move a bit to the right, and then we can call in on Mrs. Mariah Peen. She's a Swiss woman, married to a Chinese. I'd better say Chinese man, or our women's liberal right, and ask how a woman could marry a woman. Although, I understand they do nowadays. In fact, I read something about it recently. Anyway, Maria Peen is a woman with such a lot of abilities, but unfortunately she has a family and the family takes up a lot of her time. When you have a family taking up time, then you have to put aside your own inclinations, don't you? And get on and look after your responsibilities. So, hello, Maria. Glad to mention you as a friend of mine. Another one, and this time a man, Brian Rush. He is an old correspondent of mine, too. We've been writing to each other for, oh, I wouldn't like to say how long, to be quite honest. I can't remember how long. It's been such a time ago. But he's one of my earliest correspondents. Ruby Simmons is another. She is the one who wrote to me. Well, I think she wrote to me actually before Mrs. Cuthbert did. As far as I remember now, Ruby Simmons was actually the first correspondent in the USA, and we write regularly, and that's why she's listed here as one of my friends. Away in Vancouver, there's a lady who attracted me very much because of her interest in bonsai. That, you know, is Japanese dwarf trees. Mrs. Edith Tiro knows a lot about gardens and plants and all that, and we've made quite a friendship because of our mutual interest in dwarf trees. As a matter of interest, she came to see me the weekend before last. Of all curious things, she got in her car on a Friday evening and drove 670 miles or so from Vancouver to Calgary. She stayed at my house a very short time indeed, and then hopped back into her car and drove all the way back to Vancouver so she would be ready for work at the start of the week. Now, isn't that a good friend for you? One that'll get in a car and drive 670 miles twice? Well, I suppose she got a breath of fresh air doing it, but anyway, she was certainly welcome here. Move on, again, across another ocean to Eric Teddy in England. He wrote to me some time ago, and I was quite amused by his name. It reminded me of Tetley tea bags, which we use here. So, of course, I replied to him and in my usual tactless way reminded him about Tetley tea bags. Since that time, quite a friendship has ripened between us. We like each other, we write to each other, we exchange naughty jokes at times. Of course, we have to be careful. We can't say our best jokes to either one of us because, well, you know what it is when there are ladies in the house. They will read a letter sometimes and they wouldn't like a mere male to see that they couldn't blush after all. Anyway, Eric Tetley and I are good friends by correspondence. Jim Thompson is another good friend. He lives in the wilds of California. I always thought that all California was wild, especially as I have been there a few times. My, they are a wild lot there, aren't they? I better not tell you how many of the people I've mentioned above come from California. But Jim Thompson and I have been corresponding for a terrific time. We've got to know each other very thoroughly. And there is one peculiarity about Jim Thompson which I just must share with you. He seems to have cornered the world market in calendar pages going back to 1960. And invariably he writes to me on a calendar page dated 1960. I didn't know there were so many old calendars left in the world. Anyway, Jim Thompson and I are quite good friends. Glory be! Do you know I have given 20 people already? 20, think of that. Still, some of you have asked about my friends, so now you're getting some information about a few of them. I think we'll mention just one more, because this is a friend in Belgium, Miss L.C. Vanderporten. She's a very important lady indeed, with many business interests, and we write to each other, not too often, but enough to ensure that there is a good friendship. She's such a busy woman with her business interests, and I think she hasn't too much time for private correspondence. I know just how she feels. I want then to say hello to Miss Vanderporten, away in far-off Belgium. Well, those of you who have asked me about my friends and have impolitely intimated that I couldn't have any friends, you might be a little surprised, eh? Mind you, I know I've left out a lot of people in this small reference, but if I added any more, I'm sure my publisher would have something to say. Hey, though, Mr. Publisher, I've got you after all. You said you wanted a book answering readers' questions. Well, honorable sir, that's what I'm doing. A lady libber. Sorry, no women's libber can be a lady by their own admission. A lady libber asked me if I didn't have any friends, and if I had, then list them on the back of a postage stamp. It would have to be a big postage stamp, wouldn't it? But I have given just a few, so I haven't broken any rules, Mr. Publisher. I'm answering readers' questions. End of chapter 3.